So we're continuing our study of Sefer Melachim, and we're towards the beginning, in the middle of Perek Zayin. So we're up to Perek Zayin, Pasuk Tezvav, and really up to a specific area that Shlomo needed to bring in kind of reinforcement to help with the craftsmanship, specifically of some of the materials that dealt with copper, things that were made out of nechoshes. Nechoshes was something that played a role in the building of the Mishkan, and it continued to play a role. We're going to see it played, at least if you add up the amount of psukim that are going to be devoted to the items that are made out of copper. So I think probably the biggest impact that it's going to make on all of us, I know this is how in reading it myself, is there are a lot of psukim devoted to that which is copper, and the things that are made out of copper seem to be almost... You'd almost imagine it's in some type of, not like ranked because, you know, if we think about precious materials or metals, we usually think of gold, silver, bronze, copper, I don't know. But we're going to be reading about the kalim or at least adornments that seem to be tangential, and yet the Tanakh seems to spend more psukim on these items than, and in greater detail than maybe anything that we've seen up until now. I'm not going to have an answer to it, but it's definitely something, you know, clearly, what for whatever reason, Hashem wanted us to hear the great detail. So the last pasuk that we read was that Shlomo sent for this individual named Hiram, who was a Jew. We heard about some of his lineage, and he's the expert on Nechoshes. The pasuk goes out of its way to tell us he has Chachma, he has Bina, he has Das, he has all forms of intelligence. So pasuk Tezvav. Vayatzar eshnei ha'amudim Nechoshes. Vayatzar, he shaped or designed. We're going to see another pasuk that uses the word vayas, that he made the posts. These two, there are going to be two pillars that are going to adorn the entranceway into the ulam. The ulam was the fancy hallway that was the building in front of the actual temple, and in front of that is going to go two posts, two large copper posts. So Vayatzar is most likely, this is talking about the planning stage of how it was going to be built. So Vayatzar Shnei Hamudim Nechoshes, there are two pillars that are going to be made out of copper. Shmona Esrei Ama, Koma Ha'amud Ha'achad. 18 amos tall is the height of post number one, Amud Ha'achad. V'chut Shteim Esrei Ama, Yasov es hamud hasheni. A chut is a string. A string that would be 12 amos long was able to go around the second post. So what appears to be is that we described the height of the first post, and now we're describing the width or the thickness of the second post. And the way the thickness is being described is by telling us the circumference. There is a formula that we're going to see even based on Psukim here in Melachim, the basic approximate formula of pi, of how do you figure out the circumference, is that the ratio is 3 to 1. Well, we know that pi is not an exact number. It's not 3. It's 3.14. Who could do more?
1, 2.
Okay. And then, you know, it obviously goes on. But what we'll see is that the Tanakh and Shlomo himself, so particularly, had a knowledge of what circumference is, and the basic formula is 3 to 1 ratio. So that if you have a chut, shtei mesrei amah, if you have a string, a tape measure, if you will, that is 12 amos, so if you do the math, the diameter was four amos. So these pillars were 4 amos thick, at least pillar number 2. The way that Rashi explains this pasuk, because it is rather strange. It opens up with the height of pillar. We hear that there are two pillars. It opens with the height of pillar number 1 and the width of pillar number 2. So in Rashi language, he calls it a mikra katsar. It's like a short pasuk. It's short version. It's short talk. And that really, the length and width were exactly the same. And we should understand both pillars being 18 amos tall and four amos thick. Why it has to be learned that way, I don't know, the language of the Targum Yonasan, which Rashi quotes. Rashi basically, in the if you look in our in the pasuk itself, if your version has the trup, right? If you look at the cantillation notes, so v'chut shteim esrei ama, that's one phrase. Yasov es hamod hasheni is a separate phrase, and it actually flows with how trup is broken down. The way the Targum Yonasan kind of translates the pasuk is he stops after the word yasov. He stops after the word it surrounds, and the Targum Yonasan concludes v'chein la'amud hatanina, which is like, and so too with the second post, so that everything is being discussed with post number one, and then you say, post number two. That's the way the Rishonim seem to understand. I didn't really see anyone say otherwise. The way it was structured, we're going to see some of the language of how the metal was made, is that most likely it was made actually as one very, very large pillar that was then actually cut into two even sizes. And that would be the height of the pillar itself. There were no, as far as we know, there were no pillars in the Mishkan. What is the motivation to have pillars? So we've been saying all along that and this is the approach in the Mefarshim is that the same pasuk in Divrei Hayamim, which told us that David gave the plans to Shlomo, so this is included in the plans. It is contemporary, if that word exists. It is contemporary and a religious structure to have posts, to have pillars. And it goes back even until those times. So therefore it's not, while on the one hand we'd be saying that it is, divinely inspired, it's also something that was not uncommon for temples of that time period. And to every pillar, most pillars, at least in these ancient time, they have a capital. What's the capital? The capital is the thing that goes, or the piece that looks elaborate on top, almost looks like a crown. Mm-hmm. In English, that's how we translate it. Pasuk Tezayin, Ushtei Kosaros, two capitals. But even with that word, Keser, it has the word crown, two crowns. Ushtei Kosaros Asa. There were two crowns that were made. Laseis al Rashei Hamudim, to go ahead and put on the pillars, on the heads of these pillars. Mutzak nechoshes, they were mutzak, Art Scroll translates mutzak as molten. Molten copper means copper is melted down and it's poured into most likely a shape.
A mold.
And then, and then it's going to be, and then it'll be put placed on. So we've seen that the pillars themselves were 18 amos tall. Here we're talking about the capital, the crown, chamesh amos komas hakoseres ha'achad, 5 amos tall was crown number one, v'chamesh amos komas hakoseres ha'sheinis. Here, there's no room for imagination. It's just the way probably we're used to it, is that it was the same thing. The second crown was also 5 amos tall. Rashi makes a note from later on in the Sefer. Unfortunately, here we're reading about the construction of the Beis HaMikdash, and at the end of Sefer Malachim, unfortunately, I don't think I'm giving away the end of the story, unfortunately the Beis HaMikdash is destroyed, and parts of it are destroyed. And so there, the Kosaros, the capital, is listed as 3 amos. So Rashi's trying to figure out, and basically it's how you measure it before it was attached to the pillar, and how much of it kind of fit onto the pillar, and how much of it was independent height. So if you do the math, if you would have measured these crowns standalone on the floor, it would have been 5. Once it was placed on the pillar, so 2 amos were going down onto the pillar, and only 3 amos were protruding on top.
Where does he get that from?
So Rashi is putting together psukim here and psukim at the end of Malachim, which describe the height as being 3.
Because there's a discrepancy again.
Exactly.
When was the trot put in?
There was a group of individuals known as the Ba'alei HaMesora. The Ba'alei HaMesora were the ones who wrote it down into books.
Right.
It was written that was the first time that things were written into a book instead of a scroll. The other word for a book is a codex.
Right.
So the codexes that were made, there were some famous ones in history. I think that might be some of the first time that it was written, that the trop was written down. But it's considered to be part of the tradition going back.
So people orally learned
how do you punctuate a verse in the Bible? How do you put a period? Where do you put your periods?
Right.
So you open up an ancient scroll of Bereshis, there are no dots.
Right, right.
So where's the end of the... How does the whole world know to go Bereshis bara Elokim, Es HaShemayim ve'Es HaRetz, period?
So that you're saying, that was just passed down.
As far,
you're
right,
assuming
as far as
and sure. Everything.
And as far as, right. as far as we know, as far as I know, there's no Bible in the world that changes where the periods are.
Right.
Which means every Bible in the world is believing in some amount of Torah Sheba'al Peh.
Right.
Some amount of oral tradition. Even the good old King James Bible, if they're using our periods, they have to be, right? Vayidaber Shalom Moshe Lemor. How do you know that's an end of a sentence? Maybe it's a run-on sentence. So we have these traditions that there's something called a Sof Pasuk. So a lot of times it does, the cantillation notes, as my son's Rebbe has an amazing chart in his fifth grade classroom. I don't know how often he uses it, but I took a picture of it because I liked it. But Torah Mesorah, could be it's everywhere, though I'd never seen it. It basically had red light, yellow light, and green light. That there are certain types of cantillation notes that are a red light. A Sof Pasuk and an Asnachta are hard red lights. Then you have yellow lights where it's like a phrase, like in the pasuk we just read, right?
The
Chamesh Amos. On top of the Amos, that's a Zakef Katan. Right? The pasuk we just finished, right? The Chamesh Amos, that's a Munach Zakef Katan. So that Zakef Katan is a yellow, meaning this is a phrase. Chamesh Amos is a phrase. But if you get to the word under Komas, which is a Tipcha, that's a green. You're supposed to read that along with Komas HaKosera Sashenis. It flows. So the cantillation notes can be very helpful for punctuating.
To understand.
Right. And I think, you know, for the most part, everyone seems to use our cantillation notes.
Right.
Even though they're not singing it necessarily.
Right.
And even though we sing it differently than the Sephardim sing it. And the tune doesn't matter, but the phrasing goes together.
So were they invented to go with the tune that was passed down? Like, that's what I'm saying. Like, if there was nothing written passed down, were the notes fit? Was the trump passed down, or was it made to just, like, did someone make it up and say?
I don't know.
No, it was,
you know,
passed,
what I mean?
I learned that it was passed down.
Right. Like, I know the tune, like,
before it was even written.
Right.
One person taught it to the next person.
But it was never written down.
I don't know if it has the status of, like, halacha l'moshe misinai.
Right, right.
We have the Gemara lists certain like halacha l'moshe misinai. Tefillin are black. Nowhere in the Torah does it say that tefillin are black. Yet no one has.
Right.
I've never seen purple tefillin.
Right. That's funny.
Even maybe some people you would expect to have purple tefillin still wear black tefillin.
Colorful tefillin.
No, but that's something different. But
right.
How are tefillin square?
Right. There's not. Yeah.
That's halacha l'moshe. So those are set halacha l'moshe misinai. There's more research to be done.
Right. Oh, that's interesting. No, I never thought about it.
You have a project.
I do. Actually, I think I'll look up the chart.
So fine. So now we have the pillar and we have the crown. Now on this crown, we hear in Pasuk Yud Zayin, Svachim Maasei Svacha. The Metzius Tzion defines the word Svachim as Anafim, which would be branches. The Art Scroll translates it as nettings, some type of designing on that was going to be on top of these of the crowns. Gidilim maasei shar shiros. It was some type of either branches or nettings. Gidilim are strings that are made it with like shar shiros is a chain. So they were strings of metal. These are the designs on the crown, lakoseris, for the for the capital, for the top. Asher al rosh amadim, which would be on top of the post. Shiva la koseres ha'achas, v'shiva la koseres ha'shinis. Seven of these elaborate metalworking designs. It sounds like everything is copper. So seven designs on one post, on one crown, seven designs on the other crown.
Just interrupt for one more question. So the so like you should really learn the trap. Like everyone should learn the trap. Like because all I learned was like that wishbone one. But like every right? I mean because it's more than just a tune. You're saying it's.
I'm with you.
It's punctuation.
Yeah.
I didn't realize it was all. I just thought that was punctuation.
There's a wonderful school system.
That's so interesting.
In Eretz Yisrael called the Zilberstein School System. They have school every day of the year, except for 2 days. They're off, I think, Tisha B'Av, and maybe that might be the only day. Maybe also Erev Pesach to make sure the kids take a nap. They have school every day. They have school on Yom Kippur.
Right.
Usually it's local, and kids, sometimes it's just an hour. But they have school every Shabbos, every Yontif.
No, it's like a yeshiva, like it's an Orthodox school.
Yeah, Orthodox. And they like the kind of thing where like you come home one day, you finish third grade, you start fourth grade the next day.
That's funny.
But they, by the time kids are, I think, 10, right. they can lane the entire Torah and understand it.
Right.
But they lane it. Already 6 years, Ben Chamesh L'Mikra, they teach them how to read it in the truck.
Yeah, that makes so much more sense, actually.
Okay.
They're reading
with the trumpet. Right, that's what I'm saying. Like,
I don't think most schools in America do that.
No,
they don't.
Sure.
Right. This was very unusual to me when now they're reading Tiller. And,
that's a different trumpet.
That's a whole different story with trumpet.
No. But they're
but it'd be the same thing with punctuation.
They're reading it with a tune. They're not reading it. I mean, to me, it sounds like trumpet.
Right.
It
sounds like somebody is reading the Torah, and like
it can only help. So I think it can only help.
My twins, and I said to them, I said, "Why are you doing it with that tune?" And they said, "This is how Rebbe does it."
There you go.
That's it. Huh. And it sounds like somebody is reading the Torah when they do that. I mean, I don't know. I don't know Chuck, so. That's what it sounds like to me.
That's it. Fine. Supposed to get now we hear that the pillars actually get constructed. He made them. Ushne turim saviv al svachahas. Going back, kind of a little bit out of order, but back to where the nettings were on top of the crowns, there were two turim. There were two rows. L'chasos asakusares, that covered the crown. Asher al rosh harimonim. Asher al harosh harimonim. That was the kosares that was on the top. What was this? These two rows were designed with rimonim. V'chein osal l'kosares hashenis. They did this for the second one as well. So that where the kind of the circular shape of this crown that sat on top of the pillar, kind of on the almost on the 50-yard line that went around this oval-shaped or round-shaped crown, there were these two rows of elaborate copper pomegranates that adorned it going all the way around.
Are there any sketches or pictures of what it looked like?
So we have the art scroll has some good ones, some decent.
Of the whole thing though.
And I'm gonna say pomegranates.
So we're going to see these pillars had names. On Google, I found a little bit nothing.
Not like the second temple. There's
nothing like that.
Uh-huh.
Nothing like that.
And you can't really—it's too small a picture because you can't see that they're pomegranates.
Really. Right. So what in the art scroll picture, it basically has the pomegranates are little knobs going around the quote unquote 50-yard line of the crown. But again, we're only halfway. We're hearing so much detail.
Right.
These are the pillars that are adorning the doorway, right? But okay, this is what we have. Pasuk test. V'chosaros asher al rosh amudim. These crowns that were on top of the posts. Maase shushan they had Ma'asei Shushan. Ma'asei Shushan, they had flower shapes. Ba'ulam seems to be understood as just like in the Ulam, just like some of the designs that existed in the Ulam. Arba Amos, they were the these designs were four Amos of designs on the Koseres. Pasachaf, the Koseres ala Shnei Hamudim, the crowns that were on the two posts. Gam Mimal Mulumas Habeten, the Asher Le'ever Hasvacha, this is the Beten, that's the middle part. Beten you usually translate as like the stomach, which protrudes out. So the middle part of the crown, the fattest part, which I called the 50-yard line, it's there that was next to the netting work, Vaharumim Asaim Turim, Saviv al Koseres al Shenis. This is where the pomegranates, there were 200 of them, arranged in Turim, arranged in rows, sometimes we call it a column, but in rows, Saviv going all around, and again, al Koseres al Shenis, we see the same. Sometimes the pasuk is a little short with us. The way it existed for one, so too it went ahead and it existed for the other. Now, where are these posts going to go? Pasuk Chaf Aleph. Vayakam es amudim. And he, the builder, along with Shlomo, he established, he set up these posts. Le'ulam ha'echal. They were adorning, they were right next to the ulam of the heichal, the hallway which went into the actual temple. Vayakam es amud ha'yemini. He set up the right one. Meaning, as if you were walking into, if you were a Kohen walking into the Ulam, on the right side, there was a post, Vayikra Shemo Yachin, that had named Yachin. Vayakim es Amud HaSmali, the one on the left side, he established, Vayikra Shemo Boaz. So there's Yachin and Boaz. Those were the names.
Of the columns.
Now, the Radak tells us that the names were there as a, in his language, a siman tov, kind of a good omen, a good sign, that one is, right, the word yachin is closely associated with the word shichun, coming to rest, that Hashem's presence should rest in the Beis HaMikdash, so that's yachin, and boaz is from the word oz, which means strength, that there should be, right, that Hashem should give strength, that the Beis HaMikdash should continue. When the Metzudos David explains the word Boaz, he says specifically that Hashem should give strength in this house with the Karbanos that will be brought here, so there should be, strength should be for the Jewish people. It's an idea, we don't believe that strength doesn't come from a pillar, and strength doesn't come from bringing karbanos. But when the Jewish people follow what they're supposed to follow and bring the karbanos in a proper way, so then they'll receive Hashem's blessing and they will have strength. If they put all their faith into karbanos without having any heart, if they put their faith in having posts that have, important names or good names, that's not what it's about. Mm-hmm. I didn't see too many other interpretations of the names. It happens to be something just as a side, and I didn't have enough time to do the research. One of the most famous commentaries on the Mishnah is authored by a man named Rav Yisrael Lifshitz, and he's known by his work is called the Tiferes Yisrael. So if you go to if you're ever learning Mishnah, just for the sake of learning Mishnah, he's one of the go-to commentaries. I lived, I think in the early 1700s. But he has different, he wrote extensively commentary on the Mishnah, and he has two sections of commentary. One commentary he called Yachin, and one commentary he called Boaz. So it happens to be one of the standard, we probably, maybe even have it. Didn't say here, but some of the standard Mishnayos are even called Yachin and Boaz Mishnayos, because they're adorned by the commentary of this Tiferes Yisrael. What was his motivation to use these names? I didn't know. We'll probably have to read his introduction. That probably is the best place to look, but I didn't do that. So famously, Yachin uVoaz, I would imagine, if you ask the average yeshiva guy, what's Yachin Uvoaz? He's going to tell you the Tiferes Yisrael's commentary. He's not going to know that it's a pasuk in Malachim, and these were the two posts that adorned Shlomo's Beis HaMikdash. Because again, these posts are, I don't believe they're there in the future editions of the Beis HaMikdash. So he called one Yachin, one Boaz. I didn't see any connection. There was an individual named Boaz, who's an ancestor of Shlomo's. But I did not see any connection to there. The Al Rosh, last pasuk about the posts. The Al Rosh Amudim Maaseh Shoshan. Again, on the top of the pillars, there were flowers. Vatitom Meleches Amudim, and the work of the pillars. The work of the pillars was complete, and so we spent about 8 psukim on pillars. Again, important. I think you might not have thought we needed that many psukim to tell us about the pillars, but we did because they're here. Moving on in our copper work. So as a slight introduction, we need to remember that water played a very important role in the Mishkan, in the Beis HaMikdash. Water in terms of purification. On the one hand, a Kohen had to be fully pure in order to work in the Mishkan, which meant that he sometimes would have to go to the mikvah in order to go into the Mishkan. Additionally, because the work in the Mishkan and the Beis HaMikdash was of such holiness, there was an aspect of continuing washing, specifically of hands and feet, that before they... It's called Kiddush Yadayim V'Raglayim. Right? The Mishnah tells us in Maseches Yuma, we talk about it in our davening on the Musaf Shemona Esrei of Yom Kippur, that in the context of working that day in the Beis HaMikdash, on Yom Kippur, the Kohen Gadol went to the mikvah 5 times, and he washed his hands and his feet 10 times. That every time, because there was a lot of changing of clothing, every time he changed his clothes, he had to wash his hands and his feet before he changed and after he changed. There is an idea, right? Why did he have to go to the mikvah? Right? He didn't become tameh. If he came tameh, that would be bad news for the Jews. He would be allowed to work if some crazy case that he became tameh. The Mishnah describes in the very beginning they actually had a substitute kohen in place, just in case the Kohen Gadol went down for any reason. Meaning, let's say he went down. You know, we don't want that to happen. But let's say he just became tameh.
So an understudy.
The Skan Kohen Gadol, and they actually, I think it was Rabbi Yehuda in the Mishnah, he spoke up, he said, listen, there's a halacha that the Kohen Gadol has to have a wife, right? Because when he does the vidui, it talks about Beso, his household, so he has to be married in order to serve. So he said, maybe you need to have a substitute wife. Because why something happens? The Chachamim answered back. So we didn't pass him like that. Chachamim said, there's no end because you're going to make all these the contingency plan. Okay, but there was some level of meaning. But you still have to have at least a substitute Kohen because in case. So why does he have to go to the mikvah 5 times? So there is an idea within our, and maybe this is the best source of it. There is an idea of going to the mikvah even when a person is not tamei. There is a concept that whether it's sometimes we throw around this phrase Tosefes Kedusha, that it adds, that it adds holiness. There is something that happens, right? If we think about if normally what happens in a mikvah is that you take someone who's tameh and when they go into a mikvah they become tahar. So none of us can put that into words. We can't understand what that actually is. The Rambam is very clear at the end of Hilchos Mikvos. He writes, it's not an idea of like you had some dirt and you went into water and then you're clean, because we all know, historically it has been known, not here in New Rochelle, of course, but you could have a very, very dirty mikveh that's kosher, and you could have a very clean mikveh that's not kosher. It has nothing to do with that. So, and right, if a non-Jew is in the process of converting, so before they go into the water, they're not Jewish. Somehow the water made them Jewish. So whatever this power of the water is, there is levels of kind of adding sanctity. When the Kohen Gadol would go 5 times, that would add sanctity. Sometimes some people explain that's what happens when a man goes to the mikveh today, because nothing, most of the time it's nothing halachic happening. There's no halachic status change. That's why there's no bracha when a Jewish man goes. The only man who makes a bracha on the mikveh is a convert, a ger. That's the only man, one time. So there's an idea of water played a role clearly. So that's so in the Mishkan, they had one place to get water, the kiar, the copper wash basin that Moshe Rabbeinu built in the desert. That's the one place to get water.
Talking about the mikveh, so there's no prohibition about using the mikveh if it isn't a prescribed reason. I know there are some women that go to the mikveh when they get divorced, or you know they.
There's not. Listen. Events, there's nothing. Yeah, I mean, we
you just don't make a bracha.
What we have developed today is we have developed mikveh as a communal entity, right? A community, so much so that the Mishnah Berurah writes that before, I'm not judging anything, before you build a shul, you're supposed to build a mikveh.
Yeah.
And that if a community only has enough funds to do one thing, daven in a living room, right, and build a mikveh. So but if you go back in time, I'm sure you've seen this in the archaeological digs, whenever they find mikvehs, the archaeologists assume this must have been a town or a place of Kohanim, because Kohanim had to constantly go to the mikveh for tumah purposes. But mikvehs were much more popular, it just in terms of private, you know, private. So we always have it like official, like who has a key to the mikveh? No one has a key to the mikveh. So therefore, you can only go to the mikveh when it's like officially open. And like, so therefore, you could even, you know, you can almost ask your question, like, could a person go when it's not their time to go? Mm-hmm. Because we have like all these rules and regulations, right? Here in New Rochelle, like it's like four times a year that a man can go to the mikveh. So like, you know, you have to save it up. But so I think we have this sensitivity. I think in other times, it was much more open. You know, so therefore, listen, in the times of the Beis HaMikdash, Kohanim, we had, at that point, you had women who were not married going to the mikveh, because it was all about tumah. So if you have a Kohen's daughter, she wants to eat her father's truma, and she's 16 years old but not married, she would have to go to the mikveh. She wouldn't be going to the mikveh for the reason that our women go to the mikveh today. She'd be going to the mikveh for tumas nida in order to eat truma, in order, Pesach was coming, and a woman wanted to eat Karban Pesach, but she, you know, she didn't have a husband. She never got married. But she wants to eat, why should she not eat Karban Pesach? So there was definitely more. You know, I think we've kind of locked ourselves into certain types of going to the mikveh, and so it kind of sets, but there's nothing wrong with, again, you can't make a bracha. Just like a man, you know, there's some men who go every Erev Shabbos. Just the covet Shabbos, even if they don't need to go to the mikveh, halachically, right? There is some, right, a light, if a man has a seminal emission, so there's a light level of tumah called keri, that if you go to the mikveh and then the sunset, so you remove that light level of tumah. In the time of the Beis HaMikdash, a Kohen wouldn't be allowed to eat truma if he was a Baal Keri. But that's actually the very first Mishnah in all of Torah Shabbat Peh is about Kriya Shema. What is it? Me'emasai Korin Esai Kriya Shema Ba'arvis. When could you read Kriya Shema at night? B'shah Shal Kohanim Nechnasim Lachal Trumasan. At the time that the Kohanim come home to eat their truma. Because if they were Tameh, they had to go to the mikveh. And if they had to go to the mikveh, they had to wait for the sun to set in order to come home and eat dinner. So men today who go to the mikveh Erev Shabbos, it's a nice thing, you know, I guess. But it's no, you know, it depends, you know, culturally. I mean, Hasidim have taken it upon themselves. They go to the mikveh. They go to the mikveh all the time. But never, never, ever making a bracha.
Right.
You know, they go on a Rosh Hashanah, I think I counted it. Someone told me in the community in Skver, on Rosh Hashanah, they go about six times to the mikveh. They go Erev Yontif before for Shacharis, and then Erev Yontif again before the Chag. They go in the morning before Shacharis of Rosh Hashanah, and then again before Tekiah Shofar, then again before Yontif Sheni, and then again before Davening, and again before Tekiah Shofar on the second day. So from Erev Rosh Hashanah till Matzei Rosh Hashanah, they went seven times to the mikveh. It's a thing. It's a thing. But never with a bracha. What?
Do our like Shliach Tzibors do that before Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur?
So I think in order to daven, you have to go to the mikveh on Erev Rosh Hashanah and Erev Yom Kippur. I think we have our, I think some of the Balei Tekiah, those who blow shofar, go again Rosh Hashanah morning. But that's why in the Hasidic place, that's the break. They have a break before blowing shofar, so that everyone, you know.
All the men, the women don't.
As far as I know, not. Yeah, no. So water plays a role. So we have the kiar, we have this one, after what we're going to see, we have one little wash basin that was somehow enough for all the Kohanim in the Mishkan.
Was it small?
I don't think it was that small, but compared to what we're about to read, it was small. So much so, Pasuk of Gimel, Vayas es hayom mutzak. So Shlomo's kiyar was so big that it got named the Yam. Mm. It got named the sea. So he, again, the same Chiram who's involved in all copper work, he makes the sea mutzak. It's made out of molten copper. Eser ba'ama misfaso atzfaso. This was 10 amos from edge to edge. So the diameter of this round water container was 10 amos. Agul, saviv, it was around. V'chamesh ba'ama komaso. And it was 5 amos tall, 5 amos deep. So the water inside is 5 amos deep, so it's at least 5, we say a foot and a half to 2 feet. So it's somewhere between 7.5 and 10 feet deep. And it is, if it's 10 amos long, so it's somewhere between 15 and 20 feet in diameter. The kav, shloshim ba'ama, it had a line around it, yasov oso saviv. So this is the scriptural proof text of at least something close to pi. Because it told us the diameter, and it tells us the circumference, that it's 30 amos all around. This circular, molten water container that's called a yam. In addition, Pasuk of Dalet, Ufka'im mitachas lisvaso saviv sovivimoso. In addition, there were pka'im. Pka'im are some type of knob, some decorative piece, mitachas, that was under the edge, that went around all around this this yam, eser ba'ama, all around the length, makiven es hayam saviv shtei turim hapkayim, although it went all the way around 2 rows. Again, so kind of similar to what we saw in the crown of the pillars. Yitzukim bitzukaso. They were melted along with the other melting. That these the elaborate shape of this yam included knobs, already, meaning whatever mold that they were using, the mold had these knobs in place. So that when they poured, it wasn't that they added it on separately. Now, what does this stand on? So it's rather shocking, if you're not used to this, if you never saw this before. Pasuk Chafhei, Omeid al Shnei Asar Bakar. This large water container, this yam, it stood on 12 copper cows. Shlosha fanim tzvonav, shlosha fanim yama, shlosha v'shlosha, u'shlosha ponim negba, u'shlosha ponim mizracha. 3 cows on each side. 3 times 4 is 12. The hayam aleihem elmala, the yam was on top of them. The chol achoreihem baisa, while the backs of these cows was facing back. Probably almost the last image that you would have thought would be in the you know, as shocked as we were to find kruvim in the Kodesh HaKadoshim, but with a past history of cows made out of metal, you might have thought that we wouldn't have cows. So you have to you're kind of forced to go with what we keep saying, that this was considered the plan. This is part of the divine plan to have these cows. There is a theory that we'll see. The Radak mentions it in the context of the next thing that's going to be created, but there is perhaps a connection to the image that's described, and we'll mention this again in the beginning of Sefer Yecheskel, when it talks about Hashem's chariot and the images that were on Hashem's chariot and the images that are maybe found here. So the cow and oxen, that might have some connection. We'll mention that again. So that, you know, the so the art school has a nice has a fairly nice picture, with, you know, it looks like, you know, molten cows, and you have this you have this base, you have the and you have the yam. The pasuk chavav, the avyo tefach, the thickness of the walls of this yam was a tefach thick. So probably, you know, about 4 inches thick of copper. Usvaso kemase svas kos perach shoshan. The rim was like the rim of a cup, but with designs of a flower. And then we're told alpayim bas yachil. So bas is something that we haven't seen in Tanakh until this point. Bas is a liquid measurement. Masuda Sion defines it as a midas halach. Lach is something liquid. It's a liquid measure. And so here, alpayim is 2,000. So 2,000 bas, yachil means what it was, not like yachol, able, but Masuda Sion defines it as yachzik, meaning what it could hold. So this yam could hold 2,000 bases. So now your question is, what's a bas or what's a bat? It's a little comical because the art scroll translates bas as B-A-T-H, like bath or bath.
Right, right.
And we're talking about liquid, and that goes, it sounds like a big bathtub.
Right.
So the easiest, quote unquote, the easiest way to understand what a bas is. So Rashi says, a bas is, every bas is 3 sa'. A sa is a liquid measurement. A sa comes out, you actually, has a very fine app on your phone. If you like the Jewish apps, it's free, if I'm not mistaken. It's Israeli, all in Hebrew, but it's called Lamaisa, Lama'aseh. And if you're in Israel, you can press this app. It'll tell you where shuls are, where a mikveh is. It has a running calculator to help if you want to keep track of giving ma'aser, you know, how much tzedakah you need to give. And they also have a whole conversion for all the halachic measurements, what that actually is. So according, I use that app this time. According to that app, it comes out that about six gallons would be a bas in our terminology. About 6 gallons. So this is saying that it was the art scroll writes that it's somewhere between 6, 7, 5, and 12 gallons. So if you do the math, and it's saying that it's 2,000 of these bas measurements, so the art scroll came out with somewhere between 13,500 and 24,000 gallons. It just sounds like a lot of water. Now, where did the water come from? So the Rishonim who explained that the water actually came from underground wells, and it was connected through, because the water is supposed to be pure, kind of like a mikveh, and connected through at least one of the cows was the kind of the pipeline that went up, and somehow how they got the water to come up, I'll let the engineers explain. But somehow that's how the water came from. This was the main source of water for the Kohanim to use. One would have thought that if this was going to be the quote unquote replacement for the kior, so you wouldn't need anything else. However, there were going to be 10 other kiors placed in the courtyard of the Beis HaMikdash. And there's going to be, this is probably the biggest puzzle that I cannot solve. We're going to spend, we won't spend too much time on it because it's like, I don't know, I'm getting lost in all the details. There are 10 or 11 psukim about the wagon, the little wagon or stand that each of the kiors stood on. The most elaborate detail. We haven't heard so much detail about anything in the Beis HaMikdash, and we're going to hear about this these copper stands, mechona, that existed in order to hold 10 additional kiors in addition to the yam. Again, in the end, it definitely makes it, for those who are visiting the Beis HaMikdash, this definitely adds to the elaborate nature of the Beis HaMikdash. It's impressive. You know, our question that I I'm not going to have an answer to is why we need to be told all of the details of them when they don't play such a major role. So that's Pasuk. We'll move on to Pasuk of Zion. Vayas es ha-mechonos. He made a mechonos. The word mechonos, it's translated as the stand. The stand, we even have that. When Moshe Rabbeinu makes the kiyar in the base, in the Mishkan, it says, es ha-kiyar v'yas kano. Kano means the stand that the wash basin stood on. So vayas es ha-mechonos eser nechoshes. Makes 10 of them made out of copper. Arba ba'ama orech ha-mechono ha-chas v'arba ba'ama rachba. V'shalosh ba'ama komasa. These are not small. They're 4 amos long, they're 4 amos wide, and they're 3 amos tall. From the ground until the top of this stand is 3 amos. Pasuk Chav Ches. V'zeh ma'aseh ha-mechona. This is the way that it was made. It was made with different pieces all attached. So the first level was mizgaros lahem. There was a frame, umizgaros bein ha shelabim, and there were more frames between rods. The art school picture, I don't really know how to understand it without it. So if you're looking next to your neighbor, the art school picture is very helpful in terms of looking at the layers. I don't know if you can see it from here. So that layer number one was called mizgeros. Layer number two was frames with little rods going in between them. Pasuk chavtes, v'ala mizgeros asher bein hashlavim, and on the frames that were between the rods, we have depictions. We have designs. What designs? And again, these are designs that are going on these stands to the extra kiors. We have arayos, we have lions, bakar, there were oxen, ukruvim, and they were kruvim, cherubs. Balashlabim, kain mima'al. On these rods, there was another base. Umitachas, la'arayos, v'la'bakar, lo'yos, ma'asei morad. There was one other image underneath the lions and the oxen, made out of hammered metal. There were loyos. Loyos was some type of image of a male and a female in an embrace, not explained to be not sanua, but that's how Rashi explains this image. Something, you know, similar to the idea that of the Kruvim, but here it sounds like they were in an actual embrace. I don't know more than just to say what Rashi says. Why that image would appear for the first time on these things in a very awkward place? Because it's very hard to even see these images when you look at the picture. I don't have an answer for. Pasuk Lamed, v'arba ofanei nechoshes. There were 4 wheels l'mechona ha'achas for each stand. There were these stands had 4 wheels on them. V'sarnei nechoshes, v'arba pa'amosav k'seifos lahem. They had copper boards that had basically. Ksefos were the axle almost ksefos are literally like a shoulder. It's to like it's to get the wheel onto mitachas la kiar haksefos yutsukos. Underneath each kiar were these axles that were molten meaver leish leos. They had also these designs of the man and the woman in embrace. Pasuk Lamed Aleph, ufihu mibeis la koseres v'lamala ba'ama. The opening of the base extended 1 ama. Ufi agul, the opening was round, ma'asechein, like the shape of the stand. Ama v'chetzi ama, 1.5 amos. V'gam al pia mikla'os, there were designs on the rim. Umisgorehem merubos lo agulos. The frame was square, was not circular. If you're having trouble with these psukim, I am too. We're going to get through them. The arba ha'ofanim, there were four, what are ofanim? The wheels. L'mitachas l'mizgaros, that were underneath the frames. Vidos ha'ofanim b'mechona, and they were the axles for the wheels for each stand. The komas ha'ofana achad ama v'chetzi ama, the height of each wheel was an ama and a half. That's how we got to the three amos of height. There was one ama and a half of the wheel and then another ama and a half of the actual stand. Umaseho fanim kemaseho fan merkava. The way that these wheels were made were the ways that a chariot's wheel is made. Now if you look at the art scroll gives you a little bit of a hint in how they translate the word merkava. They capitalize the word chariot. They're picking up on Rashi and other Rishonim that when it says this was like the wheels of the Merkava, it's meaning Hashem's Merkava. It's meaning Hashem's chariot. It's not just, right, the literal translation of the Pasuk, you would just say it's wheels like a chariot.
Right.
They're picking it up on like that it's something more elaborate, and that might explain some of the other images that existed. And also the fact that we keep using the word ofanim. Ofanim is also a word that's used for heavenly angels, right? Ofanim v'chayos ha-kodesh. So there are some who think that there's a large connection between Hashem's chariot and the image that exists in the beginning of Sefer Yechezkel and these stands. Continuing the Pasuk, Yedosam v'gabehem v'chashukehem v'chashurehem hakomutzak. Their axles, their hubs, their rims, their spokes, I'm translating straight out of the art scroll, were all made out of molten copper. Pasuk Lamed Daled. V'arbak seifos el arba pinos hamechonos ha'achas. They were four metal things sticking out for each wheel on each of the stands. Minha mechonach seifeha. Pasuk lamed hey uverosh hamechonach chatzi ha'ama koma agul saviv. On top, there was a half ama round. Val rosh hamechonach yedoseha umizgurea mimena. And on the top of the stand, the rods and its frames were on it. Vayiftach es haluchos yedoseha v'al mizgaroseha kruvim arayos usmoros. He made designs, kemamar ish v'leos aviv, the same designs like we saw before with a couple embracing. Pasuk lamazayin, kazos asa eser amachonos. This is what he did for all 10 stands. Mutzach echad mida achas ketzav echad l'chulhana. It was one casting, one measure, one form for all of them. So the same way they created one, they created all 10. We'll just finish this. So we hear the stands. What went on the stands in Pasuk Lamed Ches? Vayas asara kiros nechoshes. Now, in addition to that, he made 10 kiors, 10 water containers, all made out of copper. Arba'im bas yachil hakior achad. So 40 bas measures that we saw before, right? Last time in the yam was able to fit 2,000, and this fits 40 each kior. Arba ba'ama ha-kior achad. They were four amos high, each one. Kior achad al mechona achas. One kior for every stand. Ba'esar mechonos for all 10. Vayitain as mechonos chamesh al kesef habayis miyamin. He put 5 of them on the right side of the courtyard. V'chamesh al kesef habayis mismalo, and 5 on the left side of the courtyard. V'esayam, the great sea, nasa mikesef habayis hayimanis, he put on the right side of the temple, kedma mimul, negev. Opposite, on the east side, opposite the south. The Chazal explain that in addition, we're going to see that the number 10 in Shlomo's enhancement of the what existed in the Mishkan, that there were certain items that he took and made tenfold. the Kior was one of them, and that he basically took the idea of water and really ran with it. Again, we're not saying that he did it by himself, but the overall picture of why water perhaps played such a role, again, connects back to the fact that water is all about purity. The Beis Hamikdash perhaps has to be the most pure place of all. And I'll task it to you for homework, because I keep coming up with nothing. This was the most elaborate of anything that we read up until this point. And if I would have told you, I said, go ahead, I gave you a list of everything that we had in the Beis Hamikdash, and tell me what's going to be most elaborate, I don't think anyone would have said this. So maybe that's there to teach us that, you know, even the smallest parts of the Beis Hamikdash were so elaborate that Shlomo had to bring in this this outside expert, and maybe it causes us to appreciate detail. If you are someone who appreciates detail, I guess these psukim do it for you. They're a little bit too humbly, they're a little bit too technical. So what we still have, next week, God willing, we will finish this parak, which is kind of a very quick summary, and then we'll kind of get out of the details of construction and get into the actual establishment and inauguration of the Beis Hamikdash, which will hopefully be exciting.
Any commentary on why they were so detailed?
I haven't found it yet.